Hi, welcome to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. This is the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Today, we're going to be talking about the issue of the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign. The global campaign started some 13 years ago. The struggle of the Palestinian people for self-determination is central to this campaign. Of course, in Malaysia, this discussion, this conversation has transformed over the years. In the 70s, it was a struggle against imperialism. It morphed into a struggle that had very religious characteristics that were projected onto it, often reflecting domestic tendencies to racialize conflicts as well. This video that you're about to see from the United Nations explains why the issue of the Palestinian people and their dispossession remains important today. And that was the video produced by the United Nations to commemorate the situation of the Palestinian people today in the world. The boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS campaign as it's called, is transforming the global conversation on the Palestinian people. It's been going for 13 years. And to help us understand this better, I have Nazari Ismail, Norma Hashim and Abu Ayesh, all of them involved in this conversation locally. Thank you so much for joining me today. The facts on the ground are pretty grim in Gaza, I believe. Since March this year, Israeli forces have killed some 200 Palestinians and injured more than 18,000. That's an extraordinary number. I don't have any numbers for those on the Israeli side or the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, who have been hurt or killed. It seems like a very asymmetrical situation there. But this situation in Gaza, maybe I could begin with you, Abu Ayesh, if you could explain. We are the 70th year of the Nakba, the great dispossession of the Israeli, the Palestinian people. What is it that we're seeing happening in Gaza today?
Right now, after 70 years of the Israeli occupation of our land in Palestine, the people have started their own role to demand the international community, who has already issued several resolutions to help the Palestinian people. You have just talked about the International Day of the Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Immediately after the Nakba, after the our catastrophe, when our grandparents were dismissed from their homes, the United Nations has issued a resolution number 194. That stipulates the Palestinians have the right to go back to their own homes and houses from which they were dismissed or displaced. So recently, we started to have what we call the Great Return March, GRM, last March, as you said. So far, 239 Palestinians were murdered and zero Israeli soldiers were even injured during this return march. The situation in the Gaza Strip, as general, is extremely critical, extremely bad. The Palestinians, 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, have been under very suffocating siege for more than 12 years now, continuous 12 years. Nothing is allowed to get in or to go out.
I want to ask you about this particular upsurge that we've had. We've had the intifadas. We had the first intifada, the second intifada, I believe in the years in 1987 and the years 2000. This again demonstrates the will of the Palestinian people not to be forgotten. But tell us, it was supposed to end in May. Why has it continued?
Because, first of all, it wasn't supposed to end in May, because the declared demand or goal of the Great Return March is to attain their return itself. But so far, nothing has happened to the Palestinians. Nobody has shown his real will and determination to help the Palestinians. We said that we want the international community to show its seriousness regarding the right of return. All the countries inside the United Nations have approved these resolutions, but nothing happened. We have been just been killing all the time, and nobody has moved.
Or yeah. UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, which was formed in 1948, right, to actually take care of Palestinian refugees exclusively, and it's a temporary agency. In fact, and the UN set it up temporarily, and it has to be renewed by a vote, I think, in the UN General Assembly every few years or something, 4 years to 5 years. Yeah. So it means that that Resolution 194, the right of return, was supposed to be enforced. So UNRWA is a temporary agency, and yet it has been in existence for 70 years.
Right. So the situation that was supposed to be temporary has become permanent. Many states, including some in the Middle East, are also normalizing the situation in Palestine. And it's interesting because it seems like the BDS movement is precisely an attempt to destabilize that normalization, stop from people from thinking this is a normal situation. Now, Nazrek, if you could explain, you're the chairperson of the BDS campaign in Malaysia. What exactly, when did you take it up? Because it's been going for some 13 years now. When did it sort of take root in Malaysia as you know, distinct from previous incarnations of pro-Palestinian campaigns?
Okay, thank you very much, Harry. Well, there were activities of boycott going on in Malaysia for many years. But at that time, I was not really involved. I was just observing, and I saw that their focus and their activities were not in line with the global BDS movement, especially those in America and in Europe. So I organized, when I was a dean of a business school in University of Malaya, I organized a conference and invited BDS activists from overseas, from America, from Australia, to discuss with Malaysian BDS activists or boycott activists. And then we decided to coordinate our activities. And towards that regard, we decided also to form a local BDS organization. And I was appointed as chair of the organization.
What's interesting, of course, is the obvious paradox. The BDS movement, very powerful in countries where there is engagement in Israel. There are economic ties, there are cultural ties, and sometimes often very personal ties between the populations of those countries and the state of Israel. Well, we have very few of that, or very little of that here. So what is there to boycott? What is there to sanction in a country that doesn't even have diplomatic relations with Israel?
Okay. Thank you very much. Firstly, is of course we want to be together with this movement which recognizes Israel as an apartheid state. Secondly, actually the boycott movement or BDS movement also focuses on boycotting organizations that are complicit and that helps Israel to commit violations against Palestinians. And these are organizations that, for example, provide weapons and provide IT supports to the Israeli military, for example. I can mention HP, for example. They provide
Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah, they provide IT infrastructure and equipment to the Israeli military, navy, the air force, and various aspects of occupation, checkpoints, etc., etc. So the BDS movement targets HP, and HP actually operates in this country. Therefore, the boycott activity is still relevant.
Yeah, and that's very interesting because, of course, there are also other companies that have been targeted. Airbnb, I believe, has been one of those targeted. We'll come back to all these questions shortly. Stay tuned to Let's Talk With Me. We're talking about boycott, divestment, sanctions, campaign in aid of the Palestinian people. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. My guest tonight, Nazari Ismail, Norma Hashim, and Abu Aish Al-Najjar, all of them involved in some ways with the Palestinian cause. We're talking about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign that's been ongoing for 13 years globally. And in this very interesting strategy of first naming the Israeli state as an apartheid state, They have divided opinion in the West, which has and continues to have engagements with the State of Israel. We can think of people like Alicia Keys and Ozzy Osbourne, who have tried to justify their continued engagements with the Israeli public. On the other side of the of this equation, we have people like Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, Stephen Hawking, the astrophysicist, Meg Ryan, at one point also refusing to engage with the Israeli public. Roger Waters here, trying to explain why he thinks that talking about freedom of expression that artists often use when they continue to want to engage with the State of Israel and its public are wrong.
Oh, you know, I'm a musician. I just want to play my music. I don't want Roger Waters bullying me. What? They're shooting the f***ing feet off 18-year-olds who want to play soccer. Don't talk to me about your freedom of speech.
That was Roger Waters, because well known as a member of Pink Floyd. In a very kind of a divisive environment that's happened with essentially liberal society in the West. And, you know, that's been one of the impact, as it were. Norma, have you been listening to this conversation, you know, with artists and scientists? There's Eurovision 2019 yes. coming up. It's creating a very, yes. again, a very divisive environment. What do you make of it?
Well, actually, no, BDS is actually just, it follows the trend of citizen disengagement, where people feel, especially in the West, that the government is not doing something according to their needs, but rather on their own agenda. So BDS, I think, is also part of that movement where people have to do things for themselves. Sorry, regarding your things about the artists, yes, of course, you should have a conscience. Why support? Would you play in Nazi Germany in the war? You know, it's the same thing, I feel.
So this is where the issue gets a bit tricky. Not everybody would accept that the State of Israel is equivalent to Nazi Germany. Which is seen as the kind of like the end of the spectrum, because there are many countries in the world that have human rights problems. Nazari, how do you respond to people who say that to you? Say, well, actually, many countries have human rights problems. Why single Israel out for a boycott?
Well, actually, there are injustices going on all over the world. I have no problem getting involved in all those movements. But the one that is happening in Palestine is actually on a different scale. This is a story where people come from overseas and then take over the land, confiscate the land, and kick out the local people. It's just like people coming to Malaysia and then kicking out Malaysians and then running the country and then not allowing people to come back to this country. And this is happening for more than 70 years, actually. And the international community is supporting this. This is, for me, it's a different scale altogether.
I mean, okay, so yeah, so this is interesting, you know, Abu Aish, to help us with this, the question of history, right? The fact that, you know, Palestine under the British included all these communities. There were Jews and Christians and Muslims, all Palestinians, all living in Palestine. The question of European Jewry coming to Palestine, taking over the state, do they have, and in your view, have a right to also live in the state of Palestine, coexist with their Christian and Muslim neighbors?
Surely throughout the whole history, the best times of the Jews, in which they were living in peace and security and safety and everything, was when they were living with Muslims in all the Muslim countries. Before the establishment of the so-called Israel in 1948, and after the Holocaust and what happened to the Jews in Europe, many of them came or started to come to Palestine. At that time, my grandparents and our ancestors started to feel with too much sympathy with the Jewish people coming to Palestine. So they offered them food, drink, shelter. But they have never thought that these people who were escaping the massacres, the bloodshed that happened in Europe, were coming to kick them out, to kill them, and to commit so many massacres. We, the Palestinians, were living peacefully with a very few number of Jews and of our also Christian brothers and sisters in Palestine. We were leading a very normal life with them. And also, as I said, we have welcomed them in Palestine. But unfortunately, they came to have this ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. They have evacuated hundreds of Palestinian villages and cities, and they have dismissed 700,000 Palestinians outside of Palestine. Right. We do understand what happened to the Jews, but we don't understand how those people who were subjected to Holocaust are still committing daily Holocausts against the Palestinians in the whole Palestine, and particularly in the Gaza Strip. During the Great Return March, I just want to clarify that the tens of thousands of participants are all peaceful ones. They have nothing, they have no weapons. Sometimes they use some stones, and you know, stones comparing to snipers who are armed to the teeth is nothing. Stones are nothing.
Yeah, in fact, we have this meme which shows two children, an Israeli and a child from the settlements who's allowed to carry a weapon, and a Palestinian child not treated the same just because of their identity. Norma, the issue of, again, the BDS movement, its attempt to characterize the state of Israel as an apartheid state, has that been successful in your experience? Is it a powerful way of telling the story of the Palestinian occupation?
Yes, I think it's effective. I mean, when you point out these parallels where the Jews have their own roads, Palestinians have to go on another road, checkpoints everywhere, and the fact that Palestinians definitely do not have... They are, it's like South Africa, the parallels are there.
The apartheid wall also.
Yes, the wall that separates Palestinians from... Even their own family members, there were cuts across their villages, and after that, the wall separates the Jews from the Palestinians as well.
Is there an attempt? Because this is obviously what was happening in South Africa, which is it was a racial conflict that African or black South Africans were dehumanized, seen as less than human. Does that happen in the state of Israel today?
Yes, of course. They are seen as less than, not worth. What was it? One of the ministers said the blood of less than a toenail of a Jew, right? He said an Arab person's blood is worth less than a toenail of a Jew. This is the government in Israel now.
It's also edited by the United Nations, the Social Commission on for West Asia, actually, Economic and Social Commission of West Asia, produced a report that says that there is apartheid going on in Palestine.
Okay, so even during the apartheid years for South Africa, the artists and writers were very... ambivalent about boycotts and such, right? And so I want to quote the Margaret Atwood. Margaret Atwood, because as a writer who received an award from the Israeli state, the Dan David Prize for Literature, she went to Israel, she accepted the prize, then she wrote a piece in Haaretz, which is a newspaper in Israel, supporting the two-state solution and applauding the pro-boycott movement on college campuses in the US. So you have this really strange thing with somebody who say, I'm not going to boycott the state of Israel, but having gone there, is now going to criticize it quite strongly. Abu Aish, do you think that that strategy, the strategy that Margaret Atwood takes, not sanctions and boycott, not complicity with the system, but one that finds a middle way, is there room for that?
Sure, there is. And the Palestinian Authority and the late President Yasser Arafat and the current President Mahmoud Abbas have all tried to have this kind of policy. We have approached them and we have agreed to have peace treaties, different accords, peace accords with them in Oslo and in different times. But unfortunately, the nature of the Zionist entity, the Zionist occupation, rejects to give the Palestinian people their own rights. Now, the BDS movement is not something that just wants to target the Israeli occupation. We have some certain demands and goals. We want the occupation to be ended. We want the Palestinian rights to be given. We want the right of return to be achieved, and also we want that Israel abides by the international law. If they agree to do all these things, the BDS will not will
Okay, but let's look at the role of the Palestinian Authority that also come in for criticism by the BDS movement. Many Arab states, including the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is a friend of Israel. I mean, there are many Arab states, you know, in the Middle East that are friends of Israel, that have full diplomatic relations, and so on and so forth. So, Nazari, is the BDS movement a rejection of a diplomacy, of the Oslo Accords, of these governments, Muslim governments in the Middle East, that have been complicit, apparently?
Yeah, we totally disagree with
the
stance.
This is citizen disengagement.
Yeah, so that's the reason why we have this BDS movement, because we cannot rely on government sometimes, because they have their consideration, they have got interest, sometimes commercial reasons, so we can't rely on them. And as I said just now, we totally disagree with the normalization efforts or steps being taken by this government. This is totally out of order, and I'm sure, and we know, the citizens of those countries completely disagree with their leaders' decision.
Okay, so rejection of some intergovernmental dynamics there. We'll be back. Thank you so much for staying with us. We're talking about the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign happening globally. It's been ongoing for 13 years and has achieved quite a bit of impact. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Nazari Ismail, Norma Hashim, and Abu Aish Al-Najjar. All of them involved in the Palestinian cause. We're talking about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign that's been going on globally, achieving quite some stunning results. I'm going to try to understand how and why. Part of it based on a characterization of the state of Israel as an apartheid state. You think of the work of Joe Sacco and in his graphic novel, Palestine. They're describing the everyday life of Palestinians. Very powerful piece, won award. He's a Maltese American. Norma Hashim joins him and others trying to communicate the experience. You have these two really beautiful books that capture the lives and experiences of Palestinians. Tell us about these two books.
Well, in 2012, because I've been involved in the Palestinian cause as treasurer for Viva Palestina Malaysia for the last 10 years, and we've been doing a lot of projects there. And during the course of doing these projects, I was actually asked whether I could start a library. And they felt it was needed there. So we started an English language library. And one of the directors of the center where the library was held was a journalist with a Turkish organization called Anadolu. And he had interviews with prisoners who had been released. In 2011, an Israeli soldier called Gilad Shalit was exchanged for 1,027 Palestinian prisoners. This is how much Israelis value the life of one soldier, that it was exchanged for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. So some interviews were held, in fact, 24 stories were given to me, and he asked if I could publish them. And when I first got these stories, it was the first time actually I heard about the prisoner issue, and I realized that almost every Palestinian is affected by imprisonment because that's how Israel keeps the Palestinians down as well, in terms of suppressing them. They arrest people in the middle of the night. They arrest them randomly. So almost every family knows someone who has been arrested, including children. So I decided to publish the stories after I read them, and it was published in 2013. In fact, Tun Mahathir was very supportive, and we launched it at the Perdana Leadership Foundation in Putrajaya. And consequently, I heard more stories about children in prison, so I decided to do a book on children who had been in prison. We interviewed 24 children who had been released. One of them, in fact, was shot dead after the interview as well. So it's very grim, obviously, but imprisonment is one tactic Israelis are using to keep the Palestinians afraid and afraid to rise up as well.
Right. What's interesting, though, and when we make reference to that earlier video clip we had of Roger Waters, he was telling the story of two Palestinian boys who wanted to play soccer, who were shot. One of them shot 7 times in his leg. Obviously, with the intent, it seems, to disable the child for life. These are very grim statistics, but there are and have been moments where the violence has has impacted both sides of the conflict. In the second intifada in 2000, 3,000 Palestinians were killed and about 1,000 Israelis were killed then. It's one of the most intense moments of violence. Nazari, people might say to you that there's violence on both sides and that we've had a history of resistance, militant resistance, from the PLO to Hamas to George Habas's, you know, organization and so on and so forth. All of them have used arms. That there's somehow an equivalence here. Do you agree?
Well, I think people who are under occupation, who have lands been taken from them, suffer from ethnic cleansing, they have the right to resist in whatever way they want to. That's their right, and I don't have any comment about that. What I want to, on my part, I want to contribute to the cause, and I'm not in a position to engage in those activities. I engage in civil and peaceful activity, which does not mean that I'm against the method used by the Palestinians to resist, which is recognized by the international community anyway. When people come and take over your land, you have the right to resist in whatever form, whatever way you can. In our case, we just want to play our own role. In our case, we use the boycott tactic.
Right. I think if people understand the long history of Israel, they also know of those terrorist organizations that the Zionists use, which also, you know, bomb cinemas and I think used car bombs, the Haganath and all that. So the Stern Gang and all those groups, does it make people less sympathetic? The use of violence to achieve this, you know, the ends for Palestinian self-determination, does it undermine the Palestinian cause? Do people say, well, the both sides are about the same, they're both using violence? Maybe one is stronger, but they both use violence.
One is too much stronger than the other. As Professor Nazari, according to the international law, the Palestinian resistance is justified. And every people have the right to defend themselves against anybody who's coming to attack, to kill, to occupy their land. This is in the international humanitarian law. It is guaranteed. We cannot compare between the Israeli army and the Palestinian resistance. Yani the maximum thing that we have are homemade rockets that cannot cause that much damage.
But there have been knifings and random murders, or not so random murders, of Israeli citizens, maybe settlers and such.
Yeah, this is a kind of human nature. When somebody comes to your house, kills your mom, kills your father, tries to kill you, surely you are not going to stay still. You have to defend yourself and you have sometimes to take revenge. This is natural. If anybody wants to kill me, I must resist myself. And I believe this is written in all the holy books, even in the Bible and in the Torah. By the way, as I said, the comparison is not logical. They have F-16, they have F-35, they have tanks, they have submarines, they have everything. We have nothing. We used to have stones, then cocktail firebombs, and right now we have, as I said, homemade rockets. So the comparison is not justified.
It's
not fair.
But Norma, do you find any resistance among the Malaysian public to being sympathetic? I mean, we are largely a country where the default position of the government is sympathy towards the Palestinian cause, you know, and this has been going on for 4 decades or more.
Well, yeah, but we try to approach it from the UN, say the UN Declaration of Human Rights, something that was in the press, I think, lately as well. Anyway, Israel violates many articles. Freedom of movement, people in Gaza are not allowed to leave, they're not allowed to come in, and what the article do not where they said they're not allowed to peaceful assembly is allowed, but people at the GRM they're peaceful assembly, but they are shot dead by snipers from the Israeli side, and also arrest, torture of children.
Okay, but let's say you list all those things, and you say to a Malaysian now, some technology that you have in your phone, it's like Waze, was invented by an Israeli scientist. Or you know, somebody in technology, would you give it up?
I mean,
So where do you draw the line, especially in a world where it's so interconnected?
Yeah. BDS is a tactic.
It's a tactic. It's a strategy.
It's like I use this analogy. When America was fighting against Japan, there were many cities to bomb, but they only bombed two cities, which is Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So in the BDS tactic is to target certain firms, not necessarily all the firms, certain firms. It doesn't mean, therefore, we are not saying that because you do not boycott waste, you are being hypocritical. No, start saying to the Americans, you didn't bomb the other city, Kyoto, or whatever, you were hypocritical. No, this is a tactic. So we target firms that are most complicit, which we can explain to the people, they are complicit, they are directly involved in the injustices committed against the Palestinians. That's why we are asking people.
Has it been successful? I mean, in the years that you... what are people actually doing when it, say, comes to a firm like Hewlett-Packard?
Can I mention the biggest victory for the BDS movement is when G4S sold its stake in Israel. G4S, I came up against G4S many times in my book. They secured Israeli prisons. They provided services and equipment used to torture people and arrest people and shackle them. So due to the outcry and due to the BDS campaigns, they decided to divest. I mean, they sold their stake in BDS, G4S Israel, to another party.
So is it because companies today are much more sensitive about their image? Is that what you're kind of working at? Is that their Achilles heel?
Yeah. The other thing is once we start talking about boycotting companies, people will start asking why. And then they will give us an opportunity to explain what's happening over there. So beside targeting, this gives us the opportunity so that people will know. Because at the moment, many people are not aware.
Conversation?
Yeah, are not aware of what's happening.
We're opening a conversation. Yeah. We'll
be
back.
Doing to us now.
Let's do it. Right. The conversation is about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign that's going on globally. My guests tonight: Nazari Ismail, Norma Hashim, and Abu Aish Al Najjar. Stay tuned. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. We are discussing the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign, the conversations it's opened up around the world, especially in countries where there are strong economic, social and cultural ties with the state of Israel. If you're interested in all that they're doing and how they're strategizing, you can go to a website like this. It's BDS, basically, bdsmovement.net. It will show you a range of things that are happening around the world. For instance, Belgian city votes to ban contracts with companies that violate human rights. So if you can prove that a company is complicit in the violation of human rights, you could potentially get that company to stop engaging with the state of Israel, so on and so forth. Interesting, we were talking about the Eurovision. PLO calls on Eurovision organizers not to broadcast the contest in Israel's illegal settlements. Very complex story, the story of the Palestinian conflict. So many different elements that go into it. I do want to ask Abu Aish, the question of Malaysia. Many Palestinians come here, they study here, they work here. Perhaps they get married and you have families here. Are we doing enough for Palestinians at the moment? Is the government doing enough?
Surely, the government and the Malaysian people have already done too much. They are doing too much. But we are still expecting more to be done to help the Palestinians and to assist them. And as I always say, if we had another country like Malaysia, the situation in Palestine wouldn't have been the same. So that's why we all the time we say, Terima kasih Malaysia, Terima kasih everybody, the government, the kings, the individuals, everyone in Malaysia for the too much support that they have done. The support can have different kinds of forms and shapes. Surely the financial support is very needed and is very urgent, because I just want to remind you that during the last war on Gaza in 2014, more than 25,000 houses evaporated, were completely destroyed. They vanished. So these houses, our houses, by the way, are different than the Malaysian houses. We have them in several floors, and people keep the many years. They keep many years to save money in order to build their houses. And within minutes, you may get a call by the Israeli Mukhabarat intelligence telling you, you have 2 minutes to leave. You will never be able to take anything valuable except your soul and yourself. So the financial support is very crucial, very important, very urgent, but also awareness is very, very needed, and even more needed than the financial support, because...
Okay, I do want to ask you this, though. You know, you've been here a couple of years now. The issue of the way in which the Malaysian media frames the issue, there are critics who say that it's often framed in religious terms. This is a conflict in which Muslims are suppressed, kind of ignoring the fact they are Christian Palestinians, for instance, or that many Israelis themselves might not be in favor of the occupation, that it's become racialized, that there's anti-Semitism, there's anti-Jewish discourse that comes along in the Malaysian framing of this. Do you see that? Do you take that criticism? How do you make sense of that?
To be honest, to some extent, this is a reality, but reality itself is different. I mean, how the media in different places, including Malaysia, deals with such a thing is like this. But we as Muslim Palestinians, we have nothing negative against the Jews because they are Jews. On the contrary, we are ordered, we are commanded by our God Allah Azza wa Jalla in our holy book, Al-Quran, to treat everybody equally and with the ultimate degrees of justice. And there is a verse that says, لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم في الدين ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم. Allah Azza wa Jalla does not order us to fight or to attack anybody who does not attack us. On the contrary, we have to deal with them with the ultimate degrees of justice. So we have nothing negative against the Jews because they are Jews, but they are occupying our land. So if the occupiers of our land were Arabs, we would fight them. If the occupiers of our land were Malay, we would think it twice.
Very diplomatic.
Finally, we would fight because this is our land. So it's not. A matter of being Jew or not. It's just an occupier who is killing me day and night. And by the way, in Gaza, the place that is being depicted as the environment or the place of the terrorist, as they call some of the Palestinian organizations or the resistance, I mean the Palestinian resistance, we have received many Jews, including the rabbis, Jewish rabbis from Naturi Karta, and we have also received many journalists from Haaretz, the newspaper that you have mentioned, like Amira Haas and like Gideon Levy and several people, Jewish people, and nothing happened to them, despite the fact that they were hosted by Hamas itself. So this approves, and even Ismail Haniyeh himself, the leader of Hamas, has received these rabbis and has dealt with them peacefully. So nothing, we have nothing negative against the Jews because they're Jews.
Thank you for clearing that up. Norma, do you think there is compassion fatigue for the Palestinian and for the Palestinian cause?
That's what I worry about because, you know, as a fundraiser, and we've sent millions over for the last 10 years, but the need is still there. Today, my friend in Gaza called me and he says, please, can you try to get some funds because it's winter now and those houses that were destroyed and demolished in 2014, people are still living on the streets. And he says, can you raise funds to repair homes and to build homes for these families who are out in the cold? So definitely, yes, we still need to. Yes, but I see that the reason why I did the books is because we can't just focus on charity and relief. We have to focus on advocacy, which is what the BDS is about. We need to inform people so they can inform their governments. And particularly, my books are aimed in the West because without the support of the US and the $3 billion that they give to Israel every year, Israel would not be able to continue these human rights violations.
Nazari, what more can the Malaysian government do at the level of diplomacy or, in fact, in terms of development aid or aid itself?
Okay, thank you. But before I answer that question, I want to go back to the issue of this Jewish and religious kind of conflict. Part of the reason is of this misunderstanding is the tactic of Israel itself calling itself a Jewish state, whereas many Jews disagree with what they are doing. It's actually not a Jewish state. It's actually a Zionist state because, as I said, many Jews around the world are against this inhuman treatment of Palestinians. So we have to blame Israel as well for that misunderstanding among many people. So it's our task now to explain to people that, no, this is actually a Zionist project rather than a Jewish project, and many Jews are against it. We are nothing against Jews. In fact, many of the activists in the BDS movement are actually Jewish.
Many of our friends are Jewish, the most prominent ones.
Yeah. Right. On the part of Malaysian government, number one is that there must never be any normalization with the state of Israel, and we must never follow what the other Arab countries are doing. At the moment, the policy of not having any relationship, and actually Malaysians are not supposed to travel there, even though some Malaysians are going there, we are opposed to that as well, because the country is actually supposed to be boycotted. Unless you are going there in order to help the Palestinians, you have a specific project to help the Palestinians, that's a different matter.
What about Christians? I mean, I think I understand that Christians have been allowed to go to the Holy Land for religious reasons. Are you opposed to that?
Same thing. Some Malaysians are going to the Masjid Al-Aqsa to visit the mosque.
So Muslims also have applied?
Many have gone there. But we do not agree with that as well. Because that masjid is actually not allowed. They do not allow Palestinians to go there. And suddenly they allow Malaysians. That we should be sensitive to the Palestinians. Why are they? This actually belong to them. And suddenly we are going there. We ignore the plight of Palestinians.
They have no right to go from Gaza. You're not allowed to.
You're not allowed to go.
I do want to ask though. I mean, the paradox seems to be unless we, as a nation or economy, are engaged with Israel, we can't do them harm. I mean, we can't. There is no boycott when you don't have an engagement.
Well, the what happened to South Africa should be a lesson for us. The way to teach. Tyrannical regime is to boycott them, and the reason why the injustices in South Africa stopped was because the world decided to boycott them. So it's not true to say that we need to engage them in order to make them change. No, we boycott them. That is the best way.
And also Malaysia can be a model that you can live, you can do whatever you wish without all the Israeli products, either technology or whatever.
But can Malaysia lead? Because this is an interesting thing. If Arab nations themselves, with Muslim majority populations, are not persuaded by the Malaysian model of you know, cutting off relations, then what hope is there for real movement on the diplomatic level?
Okay, My term may be a bit rough, but during the time of countries being colonized, they will always be collaborators, right? Just because they are collaborators doesn't mean that what they are doing is right. So we should know when injustice and violation of human rights are going on, we should know. And those who decide to collaborate, that is their problem. It doesn't mean that we have to follow them.
Right. Okay.
They are wrong, and therefore we would do the right thing.
Okay. We'll come back with a deeper question that I want to pose my guest tonight. Should we engage with the Israeli peace movement? Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk with Misharad Kuzin. Just some news that just come in. Malaysia drew with Vietnam in the first leg of the Suzuki Cup. 2-2 was the scoreline. Malaysia now goes to Hanoi on December the 15th to meet Vietnam again, now on its home territory. See how the country does then. We're, of course, all rooting for our boys. We're hoping they win. Some good news in otherwise... slightly grim and pessimistic conversation about the fate of the Palestinian cause. Already many governments you would think would be inclined to be supportive, not being supportive. Now, you mentioned earlier that many of the friends that you have in the BDS movement are in fact themselves Jewish of origin or faith. Interesting fact that the first divestment by a university in the US or a college was Hampshire College, and was led by an Israeli undergrad, Martin Cohen, who at 17 was shot by the Israeli Defense Forces in the eye, but then found himself in the US and joined the movement. The question is, are they good Israelis that we need to engage with? How do we engage with them if we don't go there? How do they engage with them if they can't come here because Israelis are apparently not allowed to come here?
No, Jeff Helper has come here. Jeff Helper started an organization called Israelis Against Home Demolitions, and we invited him here a few years ago, and he's very supportive.
And he came on an Israeli passport?
I think he has a dual American passport.
Okay, so this is one of the interesting dimensions.
The BDS movement is not against Israeli as individuals. We are against the Israeli state and institutions that represent the state, because the state are actually involved in the repression and human rights violations of Palestinians. Individuals We are not against Israeli
Israelis. So if you can invite an Israeli activist to Malaysia to engage, would it be conceivable that Malaysian activists go to Israel to also help or engage? Wouldn't that be good too?
If you are going there specifically to help the Palestinian for the cause of justice in Palestine, then we are not against that. But you are going there as a tourist.
Yeah.
As a tourist.
Even a religious tourist.
Even as a religious tourist, you shouldn't go.
Because anyway, BDS activists are probably not allowed to go into Israel.
When you want to help, we in Muslim Care has sent many delegates to Al-Aqsa to help the Palestinian people in the holy city. As long as you are going there to help, this is very good.
And does the Malaysian government support and give you access to Israel? I mean, how does the Malaysian go to Israel today? Do they have to go to the embassy down in Singapore to get the visa?
To be honest, I have no idea. But because
you get a visa from Jordan.
But I believe they travel to different countries, mainly to Jordan, and from Jordan they go there. And by the way, this is very dangerous because. The Zionist occupiers are very clever, very skilled to hide their crimes and their atrocities against the Palestinians. The Malay people hear and listen about the massacres committed against the Palestinians, and in some way they have a certain image in their minds regarding the Zionist occupiers. But when they go there, they are being welcomed by the most handsome Israeli soldier. And the most beautiful Israeli female soldiers, they would welcome them, facilitate everything for them to go and pray in the Masjid al-Aqsa. And they would say or tell them, look, the problem is not in us. It's in those Palestinian terrorists who keep throwing stones at us. So this, and to be honest, I talked to some Malaysians who visited al-Aqsa and came back. They told me, honestly, the Jews are very, and the Israeli soldiers are very kind and very, very nice. So this is very, very critical, to be honest.
Okay, so then what are we left with? I mean, if this is a potential, right? Did you normalize or humanize the other, you know, the enemy, as it were? But in wanting to build peace, in wanting to imagine a future where everybody can coexist, don't you have to do that? Don't you have to see the humanity in the other person?
I don't think it's up to us. I think it's up to the Israeli government. After all, the UN has come up with a report that documents and confirms that it's an apartheid state. So really, like Oslo, they never carried out any of the terms in the agreement of Oslo, you know, and it was just a trick. I think it was a delay tactic to continue building settlements when actually Oslo was supposed to resolve all these problems and create a two-state solution. But it's impossible now because there's no land left where the Israelis have not built settlements. So
it's not as if you're not giving any choice to the Israelis.
Yes.
The BDS movement has got three demands. Number one is to allow the Palestinians to go back, which is correct, which is actually right of return, which United Nations has already ratified.
Yeah.
Number two, they must end the occupation of the of the West Bank and also end the siege of Gaza, which they are doing now, which are killing the Gazans now in their hundreds. And then the people in what was formerly Palestine, now Israel, they must be given the same right and equality, which is
interesting. Is it possible? I know the two-state solution is always referred to. Is the future for Israel really a unified state in which all people of the Palestinian lands, Muslim, Christians, Jews, can live together as equal citizens? Is that a possibility?
By the way, back to the religious issue and to your question, is there good Israelis or Jews? In our Quran, again, as Muslims, Allah Azza wa Jalla says, لَيْسُ سَوَاءَ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ أُمَّةٌ قَائِمَةٌ يَتْلُونَ آيَاتِ اللَّهِ أَنَا اللَّيْلِ وَهُمْ سَجُدُونَ. Allah says that the people of the book, which means the Jews are part of them, are not all the same. Some of them are good people, some of them are very honest people. And we do believe in this because this is our Quran. And we do believe that there are some very good people. And that's why we have received Jewish people, Israeli people, inside the Gaza Strip, including Anne Wright. Maybe she came here to Malaysia, Medea Benjamin, Tag, and different people. So it is possible. We are very open to everybody to cooperate with so that we can get our rights back. We are ready to have any kind of solution to live in dignity, in peace, and in justice. We need justice. We need justice to be served and to prevail. any solution is okay as long as it guarantees justice and peace for the Palestinians. But unfortunately, as I told you, many accords, many treaties were signed by the representatives of the Palestinians. Now, by the way, the Palestinian resistance has nothing to say regarding reaching a just and peaceful solution for the Palestinian issue. And they also agree to some extent to the two-state solution. They are okay with having a state in the borders of 1967, but with the return of the Palestinian refugees and with Al-Quds, the whole Jerusalem, as a capital of the Palestinian state.
Right. So that is, of course, quite controversial in what Netanyahu is doing and supported, of course, by Donald Trump. Big issues for us to discuss. But very quickly, in the remaining time that we have, Nazari, what can Malaysians who are interested to help out do? What is the BDS movement campaign here doing that they can plug themselves into?
Thank you very much. Number one is they must do their homework to understand the origin of the conflict and then find out what's happening over there. Without understanding what is happening over there, it's difficult to find a motivation to help the Palestinian. Secondly, is of course we welcome Malaysians to be part of the BDS movement. It's not very difficult. We just highlight what is happening over there, and then also make sure that there is put pressure on the Malaysian government to never normalize relations with Israel.
But is there any danger that Malaysia is going to normalize
relations? Well, we saw what happened in Oman and what happened in Bahrain, what happened in Egypt. So it's possible, and we hope it's not going to happen. And I think it depends on the people. If the people say, no, we won't tolerate it, the government is not going to do that. So we need the Malaysians to continue to make sure that there is no normalization with Israel until the three demands of the BDS movement is are fulfilled.
Okay, Norma, in the remaining minute that we have, so what would you say to Malaysians who want to help out in any kind of way?
Knowledge is power, and you can always spread news about what's happening to the Palestinians on social media. In fact, Israel is very afraid of the BDS movement. That's why we welcome more and more people to join us. Israel has a big budget of about $70 million to combat BDS, because this is spreading around the world. It's a civil rights movement. It's the way that we can take power in our own hands. And in fact, BDS activists are now not allowed to go into Israel. So I think if we wanted to go and visit, we may not be
How
allowed
they
to.
How would they know that you're a BDS activist? I guess they have the intelligence.
Yes, they do. Yes, yes. Well, you know, we'd like to visit one day, but, you know, when the circumstances are right.
Okay, Abu Aish, very quickly, you're part of an organization here. How can Malaysians plug into that and help you out?
The most important thing, as I said, is raising awareness. And as Sister Norma said, knowledge is power. We need to spread the word. We need to increase awareness. We need to tell more people about the reality in Palestine, the BDS. And since BDS has too much strength and power among the students, we call upon the Malaysian students and the Malaysian Students' Councils to try to have some connections with the Palestinian students in the occupied territories. I myself, I work at the Ministry of Education and Higher Education, and we are very happy to receive any people or any students who want to have a connection with the Palestinian students there, to know their fears, to know their hopes.
Thank you so much. Sorry, I had to kind of end this discussion. It's a fascinating one. We'll bring you back for more. I've been speaking to Nazari Ismail, Norma Hashem, Abu Aish Al-Najjar. And the question today, boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign globally. Where does Malaysia stand in this global movement? I'm Sharad Kutin, and this has been Let's Talk with me, only on Astro 1E.